People talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars, we fight, driving about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fight beside me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me, running down with life, I'm fighting and falling down to me. If you don't love it, leave it, let this song I'm singing be a warning. If you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They live on milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fight beside me. Yeah, walking down real life, I'm fighting and fighting that key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fight beside me. Yeah, walking on the fight beside me. Running down real life, I'm if you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fight beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fight inside of me, and that's the name of this program. Here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com with lots more news and views for our people. And of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you may be listening this morning in the European Heartland. I'm going to play today excellent interview on Red Ice Radio with Professor Kevin MacDonald, probably the greatest living expert in our movement on the actions of Jews and so on and the history. And he's not a ranter and raver, but he does try to look at things from a scientific point of view and historical point of view. Why organized Jews have done some of the things that they have done over the years. So I know you'll find this very, very interesting, very helpful.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Thank you so much for tuning in. It's great to have you here, Henrik with Red Ice TV. And today we're talking with Kevin MacDonald, the Professor Kevin MacDonald. We have him back on the show. He's, of course, been featured many times on Red Ice. But I'm initiating or starting a new series to kind of try to reintroduce some bigger names in the countering the anti-white movement, people that are pro-European, people are speaking up against the globalization process and kind of the more pro-nationalist voices. There's a lot of different labels, of course, you could put on people in the kind of field, really, of interest that we cover here. But so, you know, we're going to do a series where we kind of go through some of the, early work, really, of some of the more important voices in this field. And so, again, for those who don't know, there's a lot of new people coming aboard all the time. So Kevin MacDonald is a professor emeritus of psychology at California State University in Long Beach. After receiving his master's degree in evolutionary biology, received a PhD in behavioral science, both at the University of Connecticut. Since assuming his position at California State University in Long Beach, his research has focused on developing evolutionary perspectives on culture, developmental psychology and personality theory, and this includes also the origins and maintenance of monogamous marriage in Western Europe, and ethnic relations or group evolutionary strategy. Now, he's the author of more than 100 scholarly papers and reviews, and several books. The most recent book is Individualism and Western Liberal Tradition, Evolutionary Origins, History, and Prospects for the Future, released in 2019. We had Kevin with us a little bit while ago, speaking about this book. Of course, there's some other books too, some other maybe more famous, if you will, that's been out for a while, like The Culture of Critique and Evolutionary Analysis of Jewish Involvement in 20th Century Intellectual and Political Movements. It was released in 1998. And then you have Separation and Its Discontents Towards an Evolutionary Theory of Antisemitism, also from 1998, and A People That Shall Dwell Alone, Judaism as a Group Evolutionary Strategy, released in 1994. So, Kevin, it's great to have you back again, and thank you so much for coming on.
It's great to be here, Henry. You know, I notice your office is much neater than mine.
It's just a big set, you know. No, they're actually real, you know. It's actually real stuff, including the bookshelf, with, of course, some of your books in there, too, and some of the Occidental Quarterlies back in there, too. So, some great stuff. Now, Kevin, again, so the goal of this a little bit is to kind of reintroduce some people and their work to, you know, to our audience, and there's a lot of new people coming aboard all the time. And why don't you just tell us a little bit about, I mean, as I read, you're a professor, psychology, you were working in the early days. Now, I want to get into this idea of how you ended up writing and talking about the things that you write and talk about today. What happened at university?
Well, I mean, I had a sort of normal career for a long time. I mean, I was my education was evolutionary psychology, sort of. But I was also a developmental psychologist. I taught developmental psychology and personality psychology. I did research in those areas, and one aspect of developmental psychology was the history of child development, because the children don't develop the same in all historical eras. And so I started reading about the history, and I wrote a book in 1998 on social and personality development, and one section of that book had to do with socializing children in ancient Sparta. And it really got me the idea of a group evolutionary strategy. I mean, this was clearly a very thought out, conscious strategy where they decided how to organize their society in every possible way, including socializing children. They were socializing soldiers and military. There was no other real avenue in their society for anything. And that kind of research, I got into monogamy in Europe, because monogamy is a big problem in evolutionary thinking, because, you know, theoretically, rich and powerful males should have quite a few women. They should dominate the women. They should, like harems, you know, as you see in ancient China and Muslim countries and Africa and all that. But you don't see them in Western culture. And so what's going on there? So that was a very formative period in the 1980s. But this it really led into the most recent book, and Individualism, that you mentioned, because all that research began in the 1980s. The family research, the research on monogamy, I started really getting into European history. And I published a number of things in the late 80s and actually beginning in the early 80s. Into the 1990s, and then I got interested in Judaism's group evolutionary strategy, and just as a sort of intellectual exercise, but it was a follow-up, really, of the stuff on Sparta that I'd already done. But I thought that, you know, that if I discussed Jews, it'd be much more interesting, it would relate to the current world as opposed to ancient Sparta, which is ancient history.
So that's just kind of one topic in a string of many that you started looking at, in other words.
It was, but they all sort of came together in the end, because my most recent book does all of the above. You know, it does talk about the family stuff, it talks about monogamy, it talks about Jewish issues. So it really sort of companion everything I've ever done, including personality psychology. I have a chapter on psychology, including personality psychology, social psychology, and so on. So it's really my scholarly career right in there in that book.
Right.
Kind of a, I have to admit, it's not for everyone. That's 500 and some pages. You know. But that's where I have been.
So tell us about that in terms of what you found in terms of Judaism and how you, because obviously this being, you know, the prominent topic, of course, of your more recent years here for a long time now, just studying Judaism as a group evolutionary strategy and stuff like that. You, as you said, you had a background in psychology and stuff, but what, tell us what expanded that subject or what made you continue looking at it?
Yeah, it turned into three books. I had no idea would that do that. I started out, it really was, as I say, a follow-up to the Trail on Sparta. And it really was, but, you know, was the thing about Judaism is that you're talking about long stretches of historical time, and you're talking about an area that has huge amount of writing on it. You know, there's always been Jewish, and some non-Jewish scholars have been over this, you know, for hundreds of years, really. And so it would provide a much more detailed, in-depth kind of perspective on a group strategy. And so I thought it was intellectually viable, but I did the same kinds of things. I talked about socializing children. I started with the Old Testament and how it was their abhorrence of intermarriage, you know, again, just like with Sparta, there was a very clear evolutionary strategy there. In this case, it was Moses. You know, he set down the law. He set down how we're going to behave. And they had these different tribes, like 13 tribes, I guess. And the whole tribal thing was, you know, led to some conflict within the society. But then after the Babylonian captivity, they really became consciously a diaspora people. They understood that what we were going to do in the future would be to sort of live in other communities, like in the Roman Empire, in Egypt, as a community, a closed-off community. We're going to be by ourselves. We're not going to allow any mating, you know, to come in, no miscegenation. And we're going to also raise our children to be scholars. There's going to be a lot of emphasis on literacy, a lot of emphasis on business, a lot of emphasis on creating monopolies within the group, and really treating outgroups horribly. I mean, we see that today with Orthodox Jews. And actually, there's a big problem in New York now.
Yeah.
With the Orthodox Jews, they tend to go in certain areas, but they don't treat the people around them nicely. And you know, all the landlords and so on in Brooklyn, they are very pretty tough.
But you're saying you found this, like, as a conscious, written out, that then I would assume, strategy of the group.
Right. It's the same way with Sparta. It's written out. This is how we're going to be hit. And this is the year. We're not going to allow anyone else in. It's also the case with Sparta. They didn't allow a lot of people in. They had a way of socializing children. And they had a way of, they ignored the arts, they ignored literature, everything like that. It was all military. You know, you're going to be trained to be a soldier. And they dominated these other people. They made them into slaves. So they could then pursue this military life. And they were incredibly good soldiers for a small society, really. They dominated Greece. For a long time, they had a huge war with Athens, very debilitating war on both sides, really. Incredible people. You know, they were the ones that stood up for the Persians and really defeated the Persians in the Battle of Thermopylae, I believe. You know, that really saved the West. I mean, imagine if the Persians had won that. They were not a Western culture.
Yeah.
It was sort of Indo-European, but they had miscegenated so much over there. It's a slave society, despotic and everything else. Very different.
Yeah. So Yeah, so you're talking about like things that you've, I guess, in your these are journals and academic stuff that you're coming across that is suggesting that this is a conscious strategy, obviously for survival reasons, I would assume, because of they were captured, enslaved in so many different empires, starting from, well, we don't really know where they show up from. It's kind of a mystery in itself, really. You can go back to the Bronze Age and see invasions of different groups and, of course, the collapse of a lot of the ancient empires and stuff like that. But moving forward then, they, of course, come to be very proficient in certain fields. As well, how do we explain that? Do you think?
It's like this. It's just like with Sparta. I mean, from early childhood, they were trained to be soldiers, so they had to be very good at it. I mean, they were training all the time. The same way with Jews, they very consciously decided during the Roman Empire to adopt this educational strategy. And there was a time there where they got rid of all the ones who weren't very scholarly, that really couldn't hack it. It really was, a process of weeding out the not so intelligent and creating a group with a higher intelligence.
So eugenics.
It was eugenics, there's no question about it. If you were a poor Jew and you were not very smart and all that, well, they sort of, encouraged you to leave, They did not want you around, and I think they also self-consciously thought that they had to do this to compete in the ancient world with the Greeks. The Greeks were very intelligent people. They were dominating the commercial business kind of things and intellectually and everything else. Of course, the Romans came in and conquered it all, but even then, the Greeks were really much more intellectual than the Romans. And I do think that they felt they had to, up their game, you might say. And self-consciously made this decision. So young Jewish children started going to school at a very early age. And they became literate. Very few people. If you look at other, the surrounding society, they were much higher level of literacy than, say, the Romans did in general. So instead of this upper crust, very few people who were literate, you had education beginning, early childhood, and emphasizing Torah, and everything else was subsidiary. They didn't care about military things, they didn't care about science or anything like that. There were no Jewish scientists or mathematicians or anything else in the ancient world. It was all based on this religious study. And we should still see now, Orthodox Jewish community. That's what they think. Just the other day, I saw this thing that the state of New York is coming down and these Orthodox communities, because they're not teaching secular studies. Some of them can hardly speak English. They're much more oriented towards Hebrew. They're isolated and they focus totally on Jewish studies.
So do you think, obviously, that the Orthodox is more similar to how they were back then, as opposed to obviously Reformed Judaism and the modern Jewish liberal element, I guess, right?
Yeah, the Orthodox Jews, they retain really what traditional Judaism was. They dress differently, they had their own schools, they completely shut themselves off. If someone intermarries, they are going to be expelled from the community. If someone is a heretic, they and their whole family will suffer for that. I mean, there are these stories of Jews, Orthodox Jews, who decide that they don't want to do that anymore, and it's heart-wrenching for them. I mean, they just have a hard time letting go, and then they are vilified within the community, and the whole family suffers for it. It's just like in the old days, if you did any of that stuff, or you got married to a non-Jew, well, you would be ostracized in the community, and your whole family would have a black mark on it. No one would want to marry into your family. So it was a very, you can imagine, huge social obligation you would feel to stay on the straight and narrow and keep obeying the law.
Interesting. I want to return to that, see if we can talk about that later, because regarding intermarriage and stuff, the way that the Jewish community have kind of ascended, if you will, within Western societies and higher up the ranks and becoming aristocratic families such as the Rothschilds, and there's many others that, which of course have become a very powerful component today. Their influence is massive, their wealth is massive, their influence is just in relation to how few they are is just completely out of balance, so to speak. But tell us again, if you can, try to get closer to what was it that took you kind of from, I guess, finding some of those things, and then what led you up to both people that shall dwell alone, but also culture of critique of obviously seeing and recognizing the patterns that this is also now something that is detrimental to Europeans or Western Europeans in particular. What happened there?
Well, that's exactly it. In the first book on the people that shall dwell alone was well received, and academically it was, it was just about how they got along in traditional societies and what it was about and how they were structured. But as I went along, and you have to be, I read more and more. I read a lot about anti-Semitism got a theory I really tried to place that within an evolutionary perspective and a psychological perspective. And, modern treatments of anti-Semitism are just, by the Jewish scholars, are just apologetic. I mean, they don't seriously try to see things from the other person's point of view. Yeah, so I wrote Separations, Discontents, and that one was much less well received because I took that sort of hard-edged view that Jews had certain behavioral tendencies that were angering other peoples. Exploitation, economic exploitation for one. That's so common, like in Europe in the Middle Ages, lending money, collecting taxes. I mean, this is one of the most outrageous things. Can you imagine a society where the king delegates tax collecting to these Jews who then pay the king a certain amount up front to do this and then just go in there and get whatever they can from the people?
Is that what happened?
It's an outrageous system. Yeah.
That's what happened.
Areas. In Spain and other places in Europe. And it was just
somehow the king allowed that there. Like they
I mean, the kings were not on the side of the people, quite
often. See, that's what's so bizarre about this,
And so what the Jews would do is make alliances with the king and the other aristocrats against the people. But they subconsciously didn't. They knew damn well that they were allied with the elites, and they would often try to marry their daughters into the elites.
Right.
They would exploit the rest of the people without any conscience. And that's the thing. That, if you look at how Jews conceptualize ethics, they can say completely within group. So you can do whatever you want to people who are not Jewish. But with other Jews, there's a huge ethical code. You can't, steal a monopoly from another Jew and compete with them economically. You have to, respect their monopoly or whatever. And there are all these rules about how you interact with other Jews. With non-Jews, you can do everything from slavery to, horrendous interest rates to outrageous confiscatory taxes, whatever. And so it doesn't matter. And so that came through pretty clear in the historical record. And of course, it's never mentioned by these Jewish apologists. And so that's really an eye-opener for me. I started thinking, these are not really nice people.
But that's interesting. That means that is like available in the academic works, but no one has kind of, I guess, applied in the same way that you had at that time, at least, applied that, okay, I can see a pattern of behavior here, and obviously this would have negative consequences among the societies that they lived, right?
That's going to anger people. And so repeatedly there would be hostility, and oftentimes you get the king siding with the Jews against the rest of the people, quelling pogroms and riots and other things, trying to keep order. The scholar who's really taken this up is Andrew Joyce, and he's done some really great material on historical anti-Semitism. I recommended his writings on anti-Semitism very highly. If you look at it, there's so many Jewish apologists now, they just want to, and it's just part of the whole anti-Western zeitgeist of the academic world now. where everything about the past is pathological on the part of Westerners. There was this primitive hatred of Jews because of the idea that they killed Christ. That's sort of the end of it. And so that produced all the tensions in subsequent history. It's a joke. I mean, they can't stand the most cursory examination, but that's the way it is. And these are powerful people because, you know, they so many Jews are academics, and they will rewrite history. They will write it from their own perspective. They will never ever blame Jews for anything. And so I realized I was up against a sort of consensus, but then I really realized these people are not really on our side. And when I started reading the culture critique, that became even more obvious. You know, reading about psychoanalysis and sort of undermining, subverting the Western sexual culture and marriage culture and that sort of thing. And
so the picture that you were painting was something that developed slowly. It wasn't the one thing that all of a sudden clicked and you're like, oh my God, this is detrimental to us, right? So, but go ahead.
The cultural critique material came in my mindset, where I really started seeing these people as as hating us and doing their best to undermine us and really replace us now. That took a long time, but certainly the book on anti-Semitism started that. But then reading Culture Critique, you see Jews involved in communism. And then you realize, 20 million people were murdered in the Soviet Union at a time when Jews were the elite. And especially when I got to the material of immigration.
Now, I want to work myself up there to that point a little bit, and I wanted to talk about the anti-Semitism. I even have a clip there. I saw it a while back, and I was just shocked at the attitude. I think you'll have some interesting comments on that, too. It's a lady called Bari Weiss. She writes for the New York Times opinion section, among others, regarding anti-Semitism. But before you get into that and just talk about that and how that shaped, one thing that, and I don't know if you've studied that or if you even know have any answers to that, but one thing that's very strange to me is this idea that Jews were always outsiders. They saw themselves as outsiders. In many cases, they literally walked into a new kingdom, a new country, a new area. They established themselves there, sometimes successfully, sometimes, I guess, not, depending on what they did or whatever. But how do you think that, I mean, because like with Germany, right? I mean, they slowly kind of walked up to Europe and more into Western Europe and stuff like that. How do you think they were able to put themselves in a position where they became so snug with the not only the elites, but even the kings and queens in some ways? Was it money? Did they have wealth? Well, how did they get there, do you think?
They had wealth, and they were outsiders, and the kings understood that. And again, these kings were not on the side of the people. I mean, the Magna Carta has clauses about Jewish money lending. You know, this because the king wanted to take his cut of the money lending. But then you had all these barons who were going bankrupt, and the king was agreeing with all that, and so they forced the king to sign this. It was an important document in the history of England, and but that's the thing. They've always tend to have quite a bit of money. I mean, at least at the top of the Jewish group, and they would be able to come into a society and make deals with the king. I mean, but they did it in Muslim societies as well. If the ruler was not of the same ethnic group as the people, you know, when you had a hostile alien elite, then it was easy. But they, in Western Europe, you know, there was a shift. And so, like, King Louis the Ninth expelled the Jews. They expelled the Jews in England in the early 13th century. And other areas, and so they were gradually pushed out of Western Europe. And of course, that is now seen as a horrible, horrible thing that shows the pathology of Western society. But from my point of view, this was a very rational thing, and King Louis was very much on the side of the people. He was not one of these rulers who sided with these alien elites this alien group wanted to exploit his people. And he offered them the ability to, it's one of these Jewish myths that the kings only allowed them to lend money. Well, that's not even true.
Yeah, it's exactly. I've heard so much about that, and it's even strange that they managed to walk into a new territory and set up a bank or something like this. They were so suppressed and so discriminated against that the only thing we could do was to take control of the financial system by setting up a bank. That doesn't make sense to me.
And they would do things like, they funded William the Conqueror, when he came into conquered England in 1966.
Yeah. William of Orange, right.
But, in return, they got to lend money and other things when they got there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that set off because they had, I guess they hadn't been there before in numbers anyway.
Here's a map of the expulsions, by the way, from 1100 to 1800, which of course some people say it's 192 or something like that. But it's impossible to know all the places, to be honest.
And then just common sense level, you see this on Twitter and everything. What's the common sense of that? If you've been expelled that many times, hundreds of times really, from all these different places, times, and over centuries, is that about you or about the people that are expelling you? There's something about you that is doing this. But of course, that never registers with them.
Isn't it about that? There's zero self-reflection. In many cases, we are asked to self-reflect. Well, was it something that I did, or what's my guilt? In this situation, when things go bad, what did I do that was wrong? How could I change? But that doesn't seem to come into this equation when it comes to European history, anti-Semitism, and who's to blame, right?
Right. It's our proneness to guilt and. We are easily triggered for guilt, and I think Jewish intellectuals understood that, and that's why we get so much propaganda that is guilt-inducing. The Holocaust and all of European history is presented in a way to induce guilt. And then, of course, we have other things like the slave trade and all that. But that's, we are much more prone, I think, to self-reflection about these things, come to think of it, I've never tried to analyze this in terms of individualism, but it may well be a trait of individualism, because we are, and this has been documented by anthropologists, that the West is a guilt-prone society compared to others. Others are shame-prone, where they are worried about what other people will think or something, but guilt's internal. You feel bad yourself for having participated in something.
Are you saying that that's consciously being exploited?
Yes, I think it is. I do think. And I think that Jewish intellectuals understood individualists that a big part of that, my last book, is about moral communities, that Westerners want to feel that they are good people, and because your reputation is the coin of the realm, not your kinship relations. So what's important is, are you a good person? Can I trust you? That is what we value in the West. And Jewish intellectual movement, they understood that. So all the propaganda is now directed at, if you don't believe it in everything that Elizabeth Warren does, you are a bad person. You are not just wrong, you're evil. And we don't want to really talk to you. And we're seeing that more and more. I mean, my own case, you know, I got family members who won't talk to me.
Right.
It's very sad to see this because they don't think you are honest. They don't think you are trying your best to figure these things out. They think you're an evil person. You're like somebody who, a pedophile or a murderer or a bank robber or something. You are an evil person. And that's a very, and we are prone to that. I mean, and it was very hard for me, and I'm sure you or everybody, when you first start this, you know, you do feel socially that you have to justify yourself, and you feel guilty. I did put up a lot of hostility at where I taught, Cal State Long Beach, and it was, especially at first, it really was mortifying. I mean, you would feel guilty. But then I'm saying, for what? I'm just trying to figure this out.
What made you persevere that and take that choice instead of, let's say, just closing up that chapter, like, all right, I'm out of here, kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, that would be the thing to do, and I think some people don't want to go there. I mean, I think there's a lot of self-censorship in our world now, and in the academic world, that's certainly a case. We watch what we say, and we know that if we say certain things, that we will at least be ostracized and be vilified. We may lose our jobs if we're not secure in some way.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, it's good that you persevered because so very few people talk about this, and now, of course, now this has become a dominant part, not the only part, but a big component in what it is that's happening in Europe, in the West, in countries that's been founded by people of European descent. We're seeing mass migrations, open borders. There's a combination, of course, of guilt being used against us, our history, and all these pieces play a part that you said, including you know, things like the Holocaust, anti-Semitism, the slave trade, you know, these kinds of things. It's all a painting, a picture of why we are, you know, where we are today. And of course, as you studied, Jewish influence is it's a major component to why we are where we are today, right? So this is an interesting question to raise. Now, why do we do this? Is to glide into the topic of anti-Semitism. There's a couple of things we could play, but let's begin with this one. It's Barry Weiss who's talking with Bill Mayer. And I kind of want to get your take on this a little bit as well. I'm not sure if you've seen it, but let's take a look at it. It's a longer clip, so we could either be paused in the middle or we'll just play portions of it. But check this out here.
Staff editor and writer for the New York Times op-ed section and author of the new book, How to Fight Anti-Semitism, Barry Weiss is back with us. Barry Weiss. Hello. How are you? Great to see you.
You
got your cards. You're all ready to go.
Get nervous, Bill.
I know. Well, we was talking about your book. You must know your book
Light
pretty
topic.
Well. You just wrote it.
Yeah.
Well, I thought, yeah, of course it is very serious, but I thought the interesting, many interesting parts of it, but something I would like to hear you talk about is the fact that anti-Semitism, it's more than just about the Jews. It's about the health of a society that for pretty much all through human history, as certainly as long as the Jews have been around, whenever a society becomes anti-Semitic, it's an indication about something wrong in their body politic. That's interesting to me.
That's exactly right. I wrote this book, not
there you go.
Of my synagogue in Pittsburgh.
That's the pinnacle of it, right? But this is how it's framed now. This is, you
this
know.
Is how, yeah. But this and think about it. You've got this Barry Weiss. She's an ethnic activist, and clearly an ethnic activist, Jewish ethnic activist. On the op-ed pages of the New York Times, lead media, and then she's here at the Rice book. Yeah, it's amazing.
It is. Let me play some more here.
One that was shot up in October 27, 2018, but because the more I researched this topic and looked at Jewish history, and really all of history, I found that societies where anti-Semitism thrives are societies that are dead or dying. Why is that? It's because anti-Semitism is the ultimate conspiracy. And when anti-Semitism thrives, it's a sign that society has replaced truth with lies. And so anti-Semitism is a kind of, one way to think about it is that it's a thought virus that's carried forward in civilization. And just like any of us have lots of viruses in our body at a given time,
right.
As long as we're healthy, they don't show themselves. When a society begins to become unhealthy and tearing itself apart, as we see here and throughout Europe, anti-Semitism begins to show its face.
But why did...
What's your reply to that? That it's a mental disease in the mind of Europeans, essentially, a thought virus.
Well, it is typical, I think, of Jewish apologists that they don't want to look at what was really going on. They don't want to look at Jewish behavior at all. If there are anti-Jewish feelings, it is because there's something wrong with the people around them. And that's inevitable. That's their standard line every time now.
Is there anything comparable? Like white people all say, well, the reason why, let's say, blacks kill more white people is because they have a disease in their mind or something, or why they rob people, or why there's a discrepancy between, like, let's say, rape statistics between, like, say, non-whites and whites, or something
right.
like that.
Exactly. And there are clear cases of societies that have done very well after the Jews were expelled or they became conscious of Jews. For example, the 15th century Spain, had the Inquisition. It was all about the Jews. And they were expelled. And then you had the conversos who were, pretending to be Christian, but they weren't really. And they were still there. But the Inquisition was all about rooting them out and ending their power, because they'd become very powerful. They were in the king and the whole thing. But then after that happened, you had the flowering of Spain. I mean, they just gotten rid of the Moors. They discovered America, and then there was all this gold. They became a dominant military power in Europe for a long time after that. Then you have England. They expelled the Jews in the 13th century. Did England go to hell after that? No. It was a sign of hell that they did that. And then you had this incredible development that happened after that, with no Jews in England at all until Cromwell invited them back in 1660 or so, 1650s. By that time, they'd gone through the Queen Elizabeth era, where they defeated Spain. They had colonies in North America. I mean, there were all kinds of great things happening for the English. They were the most advanced society in Europe at that time. No question about it. And it wasn't because of the Jews, hello.
So you're saying, in terms of the historical aspect of that, that's just wrong, that sure, there might have been... It's interesting, though, because in one end, isn't it an admission? Because she's saying, as Jews are there, and as they're... She's not saying as the Jews dominated a society, but as they are there, things are beginning to decline, and it's dying, the society. And so the question is, why is that? But then your counterattack to that is essentially... Well, look what happened after they actually do the expulsions. In many cases, they end up thriving.
Yeah, and just think what would have happened had Jews stayed there. If the similar kinds of things would have happened, where there was a rising middle class, the end of serfdom, and all those things that created the modern world in England, the modern world really was created in England, that it would have been a Jewish middle class. It wouldn't have been a native middle class. They would have dominated just like they did in Eastern Europe, and they were dominating in Germany. And the other example is after National Socialism triumphed in 1933, you had a flowering, really, of German culture. In many ways, they were very, very productive, the arts and everything. Their complaints about Weimar certainly had to do with the sexual corruption, and then they could see communism going on in the USSR and how horrible it was, how murderous it was, and everybody in Europe knew that Jews had a huge role in the Bolshevik Revolution and what happened after that.
Now, a lot of that has been covered up, hasn't it, Kevin? That even if you go back to I think it was 1850, I think it's like essentially the peak of like people discussing Jews and Judaism as one of the most prominent issues in Europe at that time. Like, what do we do? Like, how do we solve this issue, right? But that's been covered up, consequently.
It's been covered up, the whole thing. And Jews were welcomed into European society, but the idea always was, from the standpoint of Europeans, they assumed that Jews would become just like them. And that's a common fault of ours, I think, that we We do assume that, or we assume they'll become just like us. Well, they never did. They retained their group ties. They retained their sense of being apart from Europe. And so when these intellectuals became prominent, they were critics of Europe. Their image of European history is just like Barry Weiss's. Barry Weiss views European history as one long veil of tears for Jews. And it's because European society is fundamentally pathological. That's how they see it.
There's a map of Europe's synagogues, which, of course, as you say, I mean, sure, as a technicality, I'm sure you can have a different religion, but of course this is a separate issue as well, because there's an ethnic component, so it's not just that they have a different religion. They see themselves as a distinct, separate, different people, obviously, which they are genetically. You can find these. If you take a DNA test, you can see if you have percentage of Jewish DNA in you or not. But let's return. I just want to show that quickly to show that, you know, this is. It's not that these people have integrated into European society and start going to churches as opposed to synagogues. They have very distinct areas which are theirs. They have, you know, a distinct. There's small colonies essentially in Europe and other parts as well. But let's go back to that clip and continue watching it. See how Bill Maher what he hits back with it.
Why the Jews? Why do they have the kidney sign on their back?
Well, I'll have to go back to the book of Matthew, and even before that to Egypt in 300 BCE.
There's so many different peoples in the world.
Sure,
A lot of them have gotten shed from a lot of people, but it just seems the Jews are always on the move.
Yeah, we are. Okay, and I think here's one reason for it.
So,
when the Jews rejected Jesus as the Son of God.
Oh, that thing.
Okay, that thing.
I knew there was something I had forgotten.
Do you want to comment on that?
That is just absolutely, that's the thing. They'll go back to that as if that has colored all of Western history. It's ludicrous. They're much more sophisticated Jewish apologists than this woman. I believe
me. No, of course.
This is the lowest level of Jewish apologia. This is the kindergarten version. The others will be at least a little bit more sophisticated than that. This is just ridiculous. I can't even believe.
I mean, obviously, there's an issue there, though, right? I mean, again, the question is how much weight there is to it, but this aspect that, you know, Jesus was, he was a Jew, and he of course, was, I think, primarily for the Jewish people. He was meant to be their Messiah, the person who solved these things, and he kind of called or asked for a change in the behavior, ostensibly, right? Turn the other cheek. He threw them out of the money, the temple, and all those kinds of things, right? And then the majority of Jews rejected that, right? And that this is an issue that, because they essentially killed Christ, right? They handed him over to the Romans to kill him and stuff like that. That's always at the forefront in these arguments, that's the reason why Europeans hate Jews. But you're saying it's like, that's kind of a... I'm not saying it's a non-issue, but it's like not that important, or is it?
No, if you look at what anti-Semites have written throughout the centuries, going back to the ancient world, you know, if you look at the church fathers, they said horrible things about Jews, and it wasn't because of Jews killed Christ. It was because Jews had become economically dominant in the Roman Empire. You know, there was a time when they were not, because there was the wars in 70 AD, the Roman legions went in and destroyed the temple, and then you had the war in 135 AD, I believe. But after that, the Jews gradually started building up their power, economic power, and in the ancient world, slavery was the norm, and so they were enslaving non-Jews, they were the slave traders, and there was a lot of hatred. And so, I have a chapter, the third chapter, I think, yeah, the third chapter of my book, Separation of Discontents, is about this whole era. And my view is that the Catholic Church in the later Roman Empire began as an anti-Jewish movement. You look at what the Church Fathers said about Jews, they hated the Jews. And the whole point was to erect this institution that would combat the Jews. And so their ideology was Jews killed Christ. And that was that was their theology.
Okay, now that's very interesting. You're saying that due to the fact that Europeans were so religious at that point, that was one of the strongest arguments you could use. But because when she says it, when this woman and others says it, obviously what you're saying is it's a straw man argument, but you're saying to use today a theological excuse puts it in the realm of something being irrational, essentially, right? I mean, from the modern mind, so to speak. But as opposed to admitting that there is a financial element, or which would put it in the rational realm. So she doesn't have to admit and say, well, we were dominant in all these fields, and there was abuse, or like, you know, they mistreated people, and that's why they got angry. To say that would be an admission of a crime. So yeah. So they place it in a theological sense, because that makes it an irrational one to them. I'm not saying if people are, you know, religious out there, but you see what I'm saying? That could be the reason.
Yeah. In this case, I think slavery was the big issue. The Jews were enslaving Christians, that there were a lot of laws in the Roman Empire directed against Jews, Jews were kicked out of the civil service, and they were prevented from owning Christian slaves, and those laws were, you know, they kept, you know, cropping up again and again, because it, you know, they probably weren't always enforced, but there was real hatred there. It wasn't just about Jews killing Christ, but the idea of Jews killing Christ was a powerful ideology. There's no question about it.
Right.
And there were times in European history when the popes, you know, reigned in Jewish power. They would, you know, make them wear insignias, signs of the Jewish star. They would prevent them from charging interest, you know, lending money. That sort of thing. It happened periodically.
Yeah.
But of course, the big trend in European history was not that. They did make these alliances, and then they were often expelled, and they produced hostility. And you know, it's just, like I said, this is the kindergarten version of what happened.
Yeah.
So this is like ludicrous. But that's what we see in the New York Times and the media.
Yeah, exactly. She's New York Times. This is what they're putting on TV, Bill Maher, HBO, you know.
Yeah, would the New York Times allow me to write an op-ed? No, they would not do that.
No, competing ideologies and ideas here. Let's listen a bit more.
Always comes back to him and his bad day.
No, but just think about it. Just think about it for one second. So, if you look at the idea that the Jews get the most power, the tiny Jews get the most powerful empire in the world, the Roman Empire, to do their bidding by killing Jesus. And if you look at the anti-Semitic tropes that we see now, what is the Jew? The Jew is not, it's not like racism where the person of color is subhuman and the racist is punching down. In the anti-Semitic conspiracy theory, the Jew is the wily manipulator, the puppeteer, the person close to power that gets power to do its bidding. And in a way, it all goes back to that original conspiracy.
Well, I am no expert on Judaism, although I try never to pay retail. But
you're gonna get in trouble for that.
Oh, like I could give a fuck. Like this week will be different. But you also make the point that they're kind of getting at the Jews are from both sides. I mean, there was always the right, the fascists. They always had a thing after the Jews. But you know, in the last 20, 30 years, it's also been the left. And I mean, you talk about how being anti-Semitic now is survivable.
It
in
is.
American politics.
Well, it's certainly survivable in European politics. I mean, just look at the Labour Party, which is run by an anti-Semite, Jeremy Corbyn, who's transformed, you know, one of the most important political parties in his
industry. One Jew. One Jew.
But look what's happening. I mean, my fear is that sort of thing could be happening in the Democratic Party. And I see that in, you know, the squad that you and Michael were talking about before, where Unfortunately, some members of the squad support the BDS movement against Israel, which thinks nothing less than the elimination of any Jewish state between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea.
I mean,
now, why do you think she takes it in that direction, as opposed to, let's say, how Jews are treated in America or something? It actually is centered now. Around Israel and the BDS movement, the anti-Semitism.
I find it ludicrous. She is basically saying that people on the left don't like Jews because Jews killed Christ. I mean, that's really, I mean, it can't possibly come down to that. But it's about Israel, obviously.
Israel, yeah.
And you know, Jeremy Corbyn, you know, he's called an anti-Semite. Why? Because he criticizes Israel. That's basically what it is.
And that's it. I mean, he bends backward to appease and make sure he, you know, I'm not an anti-Semite and all that stuff. It's just a disagreement, essentially, of how, I mean, we can't even say that Israel is an ethno-state, but it is, right? Well, we can say it, but I'm saying in mainstream circles, they hardly discuss those aspects. But they essentially don't like Israel because they see it as a right-wing fascist country, the Labour Party, quoted, right?
They're being honest. I mean, They have these values, and Israel is the absolute opposite of these values. I mean, they're ethnically cleansing. Their immigration policy is restricted to one group. The Orthodox rabbis will prevent marriage if you can't prove your Jewish credentials going way back. So if you go to Israel and you're not married, you're not going to be able to get married unless you can do that, because in fact, Jews, they go outside of Israel to get married. Anyway, she made a ridiculous point in the discussion. She's saying that, you know, you have this historical anti-Semitism built on Jews killing Christ. Then all of a sudden, you've got this modern theory that Jews are the puppeteers. They're the ones who pull the strings behind the scenes and all that. And it's basically the same thing. No, it's not the same thing. What people are saying on the right is Jews have huge influence, that they are a dominant elite, and that they are a dominant elite, especially in the media, in the academic world, in the political culture. And they have influence. That's why she has her job at the New York Times, which is owned by Jews. You know, to say that this somehow is the same as killing Christ is ludicrous.
I guess, is she alluding to, she's saying it was the Jews that wanted to kill Christ, and they managed to manipulate.
Well, this is Paul Braun. You're on the Fighting Side of Me, back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern Time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All
the
those are Eastern Standard Time.
Their bidding, right?
And
that's
I sign off tonight,
kind of
as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada. The Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe, the dauntless hero, came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen, and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. believe our emblem dear.